Are you suffering from back pain? Well, I've got the thing just for you. 15 surefire tips for relieving back pain, plus 192 others just in case, volume 1, available at Amazon.com. Over 30 million Americans are suffering with back pain at this very moment. The vast majority of these cases are either caused or exacerbated by common lifestyle factors. Many of the same factors may be causing you pain right now. Join board-certified physician Andrew Kirshner as he guides you through the parts of your life where these problems occur and gives you simple, safe, and effective solutions for these common daily pitfalls. In this fun and informative book, you will learn how to identify the aspects of your life which may be causing you pain, how to create a back-friendly environment, how you can improve your pain by improving your sleep, ways to make a pain-free commute, how you can perform daily activities without making your pain worse, and much more. Andrew Kirshner is so well respected in the field of back pain relief. He has, you know, famous clients such as DJ Jazzy Jeff. He has done many talks and lectures at universities in the UK. He has appeared on QVC demonstrating back pain relief products, and that is because he is an expert in his field and people trust him. Also, check out the 5-star reviews on Amazon.com. This is the book that you need if you suffer from back pain. That's 15 surefire tips for relieving back pain, plus 192 others just in case, volume 1, available at Amazon.com in paperback. Check the link below the show for more information. Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Hands Off the Merchandise on BBG Wrestling. Hands Off the Merchandise, or HOTM for short, I guess. I am Pablo, and you're not going to hear me rattle on this week. We're going to get straight into my interview with longtime WWF photographer Tom Buchanan. Now, he was there from WrestleMania 1 to WrestleMania 17, and we cover all sorts of topics in this special two-parter. I was really excited about talking to him because I get nerdy about all this stuff, especially being a big collector. We get to talk about the magazine quite a lot. We get to talk about photo shoots, working with different wrestlers. So, very much hope you enjoy it. So, yes, this is the first part of our interview with former WWF photographer Tom Buchanan.
I'm doing great.
Cool. How's the weather out there? I've heard it's...
It depends whether you like snow or not. Right now it's kind of fleeting a little bit. There's a bunch of snow on the ground. I teach snowboarding and skiing in the wintertime, so it's awesome for me. Bad if you're driving a car.
I can imagine. Yeah, and I know you you do skydiving as well. So is that just... Have you always lived in Vermont or around that area? Just that kind of outdoorsy kind of area?
No, I actually grew up north of New York City in a small town and went to school at the University of Buffalo and then started work as a newspaper photographer in upstate New York, the Syracuse area. I was there for 6 years and then hired by World Wrestling Federation, first as a freelancer in 1985 and then as a full-time staff photographer in 1987. That's when I moved down to Connecticut.
Oh, wow.
So I've only been in Vermont since 2001 when I left World Wrestling. So it's been about probably 16 years, 15 years now.
So did you do photography at school then?
Yeah, I actually started in about 7th or 8th grade. In 7th grade, I was part of the audiovisual squad and saw somebody using a darkroom. I loved it. So that night I went out and used newspaper route money to buy my own darkroom and then a camera. And then in order to pay for all that, I started selling pictures to newspapers. So through high school, I kind of supported my photography habit by selling to newspapers, developing a freelance kind of program in the entire area around New York City, north of New York City, and then continued straight through college and then got picked up as a full-time staff photographer after that.
Cool. So what kind of pictures were you taking? Was it kind of just lifestyle pictures, just what you saw sort of thing?
Well, it started out as hard news. So in my part of northern Westchester County, there weren't a lot of photographers based there. The newspapers were mostly based in the southern part of the county. So anytime there was a fire or a police action or anything like that, I'd hear it on a scanner or hear the sirens and go shoot pictures of that. From there, I started picking up freelance assignments covering local events around town, and sometimes just kind of standard weather art, just stuff to fill the newspaper with. So that's how I got started in newspapers, first with weeklies and then with dailies, and then moved up to the University of Buffalo, where I also started shooting for the Associated Press, so a major wire service up there.
So what were the kind of more harrowing things that you had to take pictures of? Was there anything really bad, like sort of death or that kind of, you know, like sort of, you know, if there was like fires and stuff? Yeah.
It was news photography, so it was all there. The first fatality I ever shot was actually a 13-year-old boy who drowned in a river that I did a lot of swimming in. So it was a very personal story while I was still in high school. That image is still burned in my brain. But there were many, many more after that. And good stuff, too. Lots of local stories, lots of political stories. I photographed presidents like Carter and Reagan and the first Bush and probably a couple others, and photographed a Pope at one point.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah.
So with that kind of stuff, that kind of off-the-cuff stuff, I guess you don't have much time to prepare. You know, it's just kind of seize the opportunity, or because you wouldn't have, like, lighting equipment with you or anything like that.
Correct. Newspaper photography was primarily throw it on your back and go. In the later years, we started doing a lot more color photography, and then news photographers were using more lights. So that was happening in the mid to, probably the early to mid 80s when I left the industry. So I had a little bit of lighting skill there, but not much.
Do you think that was maybe to make the newspapers more sellable with sort of better pictures, better quality pictures, etc.?
Yeah. So a couple things were happening. First, they were trying to make better pictures because that sold newspapers, but they were also upgrading their presses. So the quality of the paper itself was getting better, so they needed a better quality image to fill that space. They were also, with those new presses, they were able to produce more color pictures, so you had to have better lighting to handle the color film.
So at that point, did you have any aspiration, like, did you know what you wanted to do as a long-term photographer? Was it sports, or was it specifically news, or?
It was specifically news. My goal was to work for the New York Times or another really large national newspaper and go out on the road and do big stories. So that's my goal, or that was my goal. I wound up working for a company called Gannett in Utica, New York. They were the largest newspaper chain in the country. They launched USA Today while I was there. So that kind of became a goal. I maybe work for USA Today.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it sounds a bit of a crazy thing to ask, but at that time, were there, like, awards for photography at that time, kind of like how they are for news reporters or, you know, TV personalities?
Yeah, there are always the big awards, like the Pulitzer Prizes, but there were also regional awards. We had a member organization called the National Press Photographers Association, so there were a lot of awards through that organization, and I won some here and there. Did okay, but wasn't the top-of-the-line kind of shooter.
Did any of your stuff ever make national sort of news at the time?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Through college, I was freelancing for the Associated Press in Buffalo. So the Associated Press is a collection of newspapers, and they have transmitting facilities all around the country, all around the world. So if you're freelancing for them, you shoot a picture, you put it on the wire, and it goes out to the whole country and gets picked up by newspapers everywhere. So I did a lot of that. There was one point where I actually had a picture picked up by the propaganda magazine in Russia.
Wow. So did you ever, so I'm guessing some of the pictures that you taken that you took were used for different reasons, for like political reasons or to like skew a story maybe?
A little bit. I wouldn't say a lot. That was never the intention.
So after working freelance, did you say it was straight into WWF from that point, or?
No, I was a freelancer through college. After college, got hired as a staff photographer for 2 years apiece at three different newspapers, culminating in the Utica Observer-Dispatch and Daily Press, a pair of papers in Utica, New York. While I was there, I was hired on a freelance basis by World Wrestling. So I was working during the week as a full-time staff photographer at a newspaper. And then on weekends, holidays, days off, I was traveling and shooting for World Wrestling.
So your first show was WrestleMania 1, I believe.
It was actually a week before that, roughly. They sent me up to Toronto to see what it was all about and sort of get my bearings around the ring so I would know what was going to happen at WrestleMania, you know, have a sense of what to shoot and how to organize it all. So I had one show before the big WrestleMania event.
So what did you think at that show? I mean, is wrestling something that you watched as a child or growing up or anything like that? Or?
Nope, never saw it, never had any interest in it. In fact, when I was working for a newspaper in Auburn, New York, the chief of photography there, my boss, was Steve Taylor. There was a small-time wrestling show in our town. Steve wanted me to cover it. I didn't want anything to do with it, so he shot it. And Vince McMahon saw that, hired Steve on a full-time basis, on the spot, basically, offered to double his salary. Steve went there. I went on to a couple of other newspapers. And then Steve offered or asked me to do WrestleMania as a favor for him. So I had no interest in it until then. And in fact, I had turned down work before that.
Did you know what WrestleMania was going to be at the time with all the celebrity involvement and the MTV coverage? And
not a clue. Absolutely no idea.
So when you got there in the garden, you arrived at the garden that day, and so you were surprised to see, I mean, I don't know if that was the case, but Muhammad Ali was there, you know, Liberace. So were they just like kind of walking around backstage, or that must have been an absolute circus? I can't imagine how crazy that must have been.
It was crazy from that standpoint, but from another standpoint too. I grew up in the New York City area. Madison Square Garden was the home of the Rangers. It is the world's most famous arena, a pretty amazing place.
Yeah.
So to walk in backstage, to be backstage at Madison Square Garden was a thrill in its own. And then to be there for all that mayhem, all that craziness was extraordinary.
Oh, yeah. One thing I noticed watching the event recently, you were on the hard camera side all the way through the event. Which is that's pretty good exposure.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I can see you. I think it's on the left hand side if you're watching it on TV. But yeah, there's a really cool picture. I think it's on your Facebook page of you and Jesse Ventura from that night.
Yeah, that was Steve Taylor shot that picture backstage. I wasn't until then, and still I'm not real interested in having my picture taken with celebrities.
Yeah.
So that was kind of rare. I didn't do a lot of that. Steve asked me to do the picture, to stand in for that, and I'm really, really glad he did. It's a cool memory.
It really is. So is that like a personal picture, or is it something that's in the WWF archives?
It's in the WWF archives. Everything that was shot went to the WWF archives. We made prints of some of it. All of that was shot on slide film. So the originals are on slide film in a warehouse someplace under the control of WWF or WWE now. But we made prints of stuff like that that we kept for ourselves or that we gave to talent.
Mm-hmm. So at the time, did you just use the camera that you owned, or were you given like a budget to maybe buy equipment and stuff, or did that happen later on?
That happened later on when I got to work for the company as a freelancer. Well, first I had my own equipment that I used for my news photography job.
Yeah.
And that's what I started with at World Wrestling. But there was some specific equipment, cameras with high flash shutter sinks that I used for World Wrestling. So I picked up a couple of those on my own budget. When I wound up working for the company, they provided all the equipment. My personal gear went into a closet.
So at the time, did you have much interaction with the other independent photographers like Bill Apter and George Napolitano, or did you ever bump into them?
Oh, yeah. They didn't work for the company. They were independent. So what happened in 83, 84, 85, World Wrestling started its own magazine that was in competition with Apter and all the other publications.
Yeah.
So we had a policy of keeping them out of our events. The idea was make photography of World Wrestling exclusive to World Wrestling Federation magazine. So one of my tasks was to identify them in the house and keep them away. So there was an adversarial relationship simply because of business needs. And then that grew, and there were other reasons to keep photographers out. Mm-hmm. But we were definitely adversarial, but I think professionally friendly. I respected what they were doing, and I think they respected and understood what I was doing. I hope so, anyway.
Yeah. I'm guessing, though, because, like, in Pro Wrestling Illustrated and all those kind of non-WWE magazines, you would see pictures from the event anyway that were, you know, I've seen, there's I think it's Survivor Series 96 where you can specifically see Bill Apter sat in the audience with a camera.
Yeah.
So exactly. Was it with sort of a wink and a nudge, like they knew that they were there taking pictures, or?
Well, we couldn't prevent somebody from buying a ticket and sitting in the house.
Yeah.
We could prevent them from shooting at ringside under the ropes. So the first benefit that we had was that our photography was under the ropes. We brought you inside the ring. Mm-hmm. We also brought you backstage. We had studio pictures that they couldn't get. And we had well-lit photography, so we used special lighting that they couldn't use. So we right away had all those benefits. We tried to keep them out of the arena. We had a statement that we read before every show about WWF being a proprietary event and commercial photography being prohibited. But we didn't have the muscle, I don't think, to force them out. And it just wouldn't have made sense anyway. We kind of needed them to speak to our fans, but we wanted the competitive advantage. So, yeah, we knew they were there. And that's the way it worked.
I understand that. So when Saturday Night's Main Event started, because that was kind of the big noticeable upgrade in production values for WWF at the time, did that make a huge difference for your photography as well, with all the lighting to help it out? Because before that, it was, you know, the MSG shows, everything's dark and, you know, you can't see the crowd or anything like that. So did it make it easier? Or did it allow more creativity?
Interesting question, because TV lighting and still photography lighting are very different.
Oh, okay.
So our major turning point would have been WrestleMania 2, and then WrestleMania 3 when I came, after WrestleMania 3 when I came on board. Thinking about photography, the easy way to shoot a picture is to use high-speed film at the time, right? Or put a small flash on your camera and shoot with that. What we wound up doing was putting large flash units up in the catwalks of the arena. So that started out of a Sports Illustrated approach to photography. So they introduced us to that at WrestleMania 2. We applied it to WrestleMania 3. By the time I came on board in 1987 after WrestleMania 3, we were putting lights in arena catwalks. When we started lighting our TV shows, we set up a special lighting package that went on the TV lighting trusses. So we always had the same photography lighting matched with our TV lighting. Mm. If you look at those early shows, or anything I was involved in back then, you would be watching the show and then there would be a pop, a flash of light, a frame or two that would be obliterated. If you've got old tapes, you can probably slow-mo through them and see white frames. That's me taking a picture.
So, what was the, this is just a bit of a random question, when the, if there was like a banner for an event, there would be like two banners with the signs on, and they would have flashes that looked like camera flashes, so that, was that just a part of the presentation, or did that have a practical use?
Nope, that was just theatrical, that was just on the wide shot, they turn those on and make it look like stuff happening.
It always looked impressive, I thought. With venues, and I mean, it doesn't get much more more current than this. I remember you saying that Trump Plaza sucked as a venue for photography or for lighting. What was the reason? What was the reason behind that?
Well, it's a terrible place to work for a whole lot of reasons. First, it was an old, nasty, vile concrete structure in a really nasty, vile town. Atlantic City is a terrible town to work in, terrible town to be in. It's just old, decrepit, old town. The arena itself was old and nasty. The lighting trusses were much bigger and positioned in very different places than we normally had, so I had to set up different lighting. It was a heavy, heavy union town, so just doing anything there was hard. In fact, we had a union walkout on one of our shows.
Oh, wow.
And the crowd itself was terrible.
The crowd was terrible.
Oh my gosh, it was designed for Trump's high rollers and friends and investors. So all the people that were around the ring had the premium seats, but they didn't know anything about wrestling. It was just a place to be for them. So it was hard for the talent to react to play to the crowd when the people right in front of them were sitting on their freaking hands. So it was a horrible place overall.
Yeah, it didn't help that WrestleMania 4 was like 4 hours long as well, with about 20 matches.
Right, or that it followed WrestleMania 3, which was such a gangbuster show.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a story that Bobby Heenan tells on one of his interviews, where I think it's WrestleMania 5, and Donald is sat there with Ivana, and Jake has the snake, and Ivana, there must have been bodyguards around Donald and his wife, and she wanted one of the bodyguards to shoot the snake because she thought the snake was going to attack her. It's just quite funny.
Yeah, it sounds completely legit.
So I mean, because obviously, I mean, we'll not go too far into this, but did just Donald Trump as a man, did he kind of rub you the wrong way even back then? Or
yeah, he was a business guy, and he was I worked with him at a couple of points, shot him and was on shoots with him. Yeah, he was just not really there. He had his own little thing, or his own big thing, and we were just a toy, I think.
Yeah, I can agree with that. But, I mean, it's been a long, if nothing else, it's been a long-standing relationship. But,
sure.
You know, and sure. There was something that you posted on Facebook recently. It was actually on, it was on Stephanie McMahon's picture of her and Triple H outside the inauguration, and it was something along the lines of, I don't want to quote you, but it was something along the lines of that you sort of hate that you were at all even minutely responsible for funding Donald Trump's campaign by working
yep.
there.
Yeah, it you know, I made the McMahons billionaires. Linda McMahon gave many millions to the Trump campaign, and some little piece of that came from my work, and he's a horrible man and a horrible president, and I'm really sorry, and I'm embarrassed for my country, and yeah, that's where I stand on all that.
I totally agree. Okay, well, we'll go back to wrestling. How much harder were the outdoor venues, and did you do many? Because it was WrestleMania 9. Did you wear a toga for that?
I did not. Steve Taylor was also shooting ringside. He had a lot more clout in the company, and he was able to get us out of wearing the togas. The handheld camera operators, I think, had to wear togas, but we were exempt.
Okay. Well, there was a story I heard from Jim Ross that the sun was a big problem that day and was shining into the TV monitors, and that's why they had to wear sunglasses, and you know, they could barely see the monitors when commentating. So was that day in particular, was that a bit of a problem for shooting, or...?
I don't remember it affecting my photography. I do remember the sun being bright and being very warm in color. Mm-hmm. What happens at a venue like that is we start out in daylight and then we move to darkness. So the lighting becomes more important as the event progresses. From a still photography standpoint, it means constantly reassessing or re-metering the light to shift from daylight to flash photography. It also, one of the advantages of flash photography, if you think about a dark building, there's a flash that goes off. The exposure of film only occurs when that flash is actually firing. So our flash equipment was designed to fire very, very quickly and effectively overpower the lights that are there. Under sunlight conditions, we weren't able to overpower the sun, obviously, so we weren't able to stop motion very well. That didn't happen until the sun went away and we went to regular TV lighting, and we could overpower that probably by 3 or 4 or 5 times.
I'm guessing that was the case with SummerSlam 92 as well. Was that your first trip to the UK?
No, I had been there many times. We had worked Wembley Arena a bunch of times and several other venues around the UK and around Europe. So that was definitely not my first time there, but the first time in the stadium, in Wembley Stadium. And that was an interesting event from a production standpoint because it rained damn near throughout our pre-production time.
Really?
Yeah. For that one, the other big issue for me, we had a lighting package that we used in the United States, but it wouldn't work with the power source that we had in the UK. So we had to rent lights in the UK, basically studio lighting from a photography shop. But it wasn't optimized for our kind of work, and it certainly wasn't designed to work in the rain. So everything was covered in plastic, and we were having failures of systems throughout the pre-production time. It was a nightmare.
So how hands-on is Vince during something like that? Or does he just leave that to the photography lighting crew?
I don't know what you mean by that. Like, does he know what I do?
Yeah, well, in terms of, like, if a problem comes up, do you sort of take it to him and...
Oh, God, no. He's way up dealing primarily with creative. So he's not dealing with the technical side of it all. He has a creative vision. And then there are technical people, an executive producer and director and camera operators and producers, and they handle the TV piece of it. And then there are technical people who handle lighting and sound and all the other pieces of it. So I interacted with all of those. But during a show, there would be almost no call to deal with Vince unless it was during a vignette shoot or some creative production.
So I read, I think it was maybe on one of the posts that you made on one of your pictures, that you had security issues at SummerSlam 92?
Yeah. This is an ugly American story, I guess. And it's a little bit embarrassing, but not too embarrassing.
Oh, okay.
So we needed to make a shot from the highest spot in the arena to show the audience side, to show the vastness of the stadium and the crowd. So through pre-production, we figured out where that was. And I had a routing mapped out to get me from the ring up to that spot and back to the ring. There's only one period during the show when the light would be okay to do that and when I didn't need to be at the ring. So there's a gap of, I don't know, 7 minutes or 6 minutes or some period of time of tape roll when I can do this shot that has to be done. So it comes time to do that shot. I'm loaded down with my equipment, with my credentials, with my RF headset, with strobe release radios, with radios, just massively overloaded with junk. And I start running down and up to the spot. So I'm leaving the arena floor, and there's a Bobby standing there. And he tells me I can't go any further, that this aisleway is closed. And I say, I'm with the show. I have to get there. That's where I have to be, and I have to be there now. And he said, I'm sorry. You must go over there and up there and around there to go up to there. I said, I can't. I'm with the show. I got to go right now. And I'm sorry, sir. You must go over there, up there, and around. No, you don't understand. And I flash my badge, and he's just standing there saying, you must go up there, over there, and around there. And finally, in frustration, I say, I'm a freaking American, although I didn't say freaking. I said, I'm a fucking American, and I'll go wherever the fuck I want, and barged right past him. He stood there dumbfounded that anybody could be so rude to a Bobby.
So a picture like that, because, I mean, you took the really famous picture at WrestleMania 3 of the entire... arena with the entire attendance. Was that always a priority to have a picture like that for?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Any big show, we wanted to sell the crowd. So we needed to have that picture. And that was always easier during an outdoor venue or a naturally lit venue. And the picture had to be shot while the outside light was adequate for that. So Wembley, for example, started out in daylight like Las Vegas, and then went to darkness. So we only had a short window where we could actually make that picture.
Mm-hmm. I always find that that's, for me, the best dramatic lighting effect is actual real light going into dark. It really sort of makes the main event more important, I think. I think that wasn't any more evident than the Hogan-Andre match at WrestleMania 3. I think for atmosphere, yeah. I don't know if that's ever been... Well, SummerSlam 92 for atmosphere as well, but WrestleMania 3 is certainly something special, I think.
Yeah, those two events really stand out, and particularly the Brett Davey Boy match. That was... It made your spine kind of tingle.
Well, changing subject, Rich Frieda is a name commonly seen on WWF photography credits. What was he like to work with, and did you have a team working under you?
Yeah, so let me run you through history here. Steve Taylor started as the first photographer.
Okay.
There was so much business that he hired me as a second photographer. So there were two of us working. then he moved positions someplace else in the company, became in charge of remote operations, setting up rings and all of that kind of stuff and TV events. So I was alone and then hired freelancers to fill out the schedule. Rich was my primary freelancer in those days. Actually, it started out with a guy named Jim Sully, and then Rich Frieda, and another guy named David McLean. So those were my key freelancers, and they all came out of the news photography business. So Rich joined us as a news photographer, and I trained him into shooting studio, shooting remote operations, shooting television, and all of that.
So was he part of the magazine as well, or were you, because you were chief photographer, I believe, for the magazine? I can't remember the exact credit.
Yes, started as staff photographer, then senior photographer, then chief of photography. Rich Frieda was a freelance photographer and still is.
Mm-hmm. So what would being making the magazine be like? Would you have to go to the office? Did you work a lot with Howard Finkel? Because I know he was commonly credited in the magazine as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depended on what year or time frame we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I started out, I always worked closely with the magazine and with the company and always had an office in Stamford. So early on, going back to WrestleMania 1, 2, and probably 3, the company was based in Greenwich, Connecticut. I was supposed to have a desk there, even as a freelancer. I think that was a work. I don't think I had a desk there, but they told me I did. When I was hired on full-time, I got a desk at 1055 Summer Street and then 1100 Summer Street when we moved there. So that was our corporate headquarters. And then I was moved to the television production facility in probably 1988, television production facility opened. It was a couple miles from the main corporate headquarters, so I shuffled between those two places. My job was technically listed under the magazine, so I worked closely with all of those folks. But we did sharing of images throughout the company, so we essentially were creating an image archive that everybody in the company drew from. Mm-hmm. So I interacted with all the different departments.
So was the travel hard then? Because obviously you'd have to make the shows, and then would you go back to the office, say, 1 or 2 days a week sort of thing?
Yeah, depending on what was happening. In the early years, I was primarily an action shooter, so I would go out on the road for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks at a time and just shoot like crazy and FedEx the film back. And then get back to the office at the end of a run and set up the next run. So that was my early life. As we got into the later years, we had television events on Monday and Tuesday, so those became the kind of focal point of the travel schedule. So I'd have time back at the office, usually every week, sometimes every 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And that was to set up the next show. So it was always rolling.
So when you were at shows, and especially backstage, if you would, I'd imagine that most of the like the promotional pictures that we see were taken backstage at arenas and stuff like that. So were you, I guess, given enough artistic license to just, like, if you saw something backstage that wasn't, like, completely secretive or whatever, that you could just take a picture of it and...
I could. We didn't do much of that in the early years. That came about much later. The studio work was done backstage, mostly at TV arenas, but also in Stamford. And we had a package of studio lighting that would travel in a rental car, so I could do that in a hotel someplace as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the promotional pictures, because I don't know if you know this, but like, there's a big market in... you know, collectability with a lot of those pictures. I don't know if you knew how, like, rare some of them are, that ones that you probably, you know, were the photographer for as well. And amongst collectors, there's quite a big, it's quite a big thing. You'd be surprised. Mm-hmm. So with, it's kind of weird. There were certain, As a kid watching WWF at the time, I obviously it was very much marketed towards me in the early 90s and stuff like that, and I attribute a lot of that to how it was, the presentation of it, even stuff like, you know, how the pictures were taken and, you know, the colourful backdrops and stuff like that. So there are, like, sort of, it's kind of weird that, and it's probably a little bit nerdy, that I could probably tell you when a picture was from based on the background that was used on the picture. So were you like sort of given, were you just allowed to do anything that you felt suited sort of thing? If it was, if there was like a gimmick, because you did like a shoot with Adam Bomb and there was kind of like a warehouse kind of setting. So were you in charge or given free rein to, it's a long-winded question, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. Okay. So if we look at the total production, we funneled pictures into an archive that were drawn for and from every department. So we wanted to have a generic archive. Mm-hmm. So most of the photography was designed to be very generic, to be useful for any application, any place. But that gets really boring, and some productions need special, unique photography. So about 10 to 20% of our photography was unique photography, like that Adam Bomb shot. So in those cases, sometimes it was developed by creative services, sometimes it was by me. I think the picture you're talking about was probably used for a Q&A with Adam Bomb, so a magazine feature that talked to a character in his native habitat, whatever that might be. So we create an environmental portrait of the character and then little pictures of pretending to answer questions. So that was one of the places where we created original art. But we tried to make it stylistic so it would be useful in other places and really develop that character. Most of those happened out on the road, and it was just a matter of figuring out what I have available to me in that arena or that town and somehow making an environment out of it.
I love that they, this never occurred to me before that they had to pose like they were answering a question.
I'm glad you didn't notice that. See, they looked hokey as hell to me.
See, that's you've probably seen the whole the guy at the convention who starts crying and he says, "It's still real to me, damn it." You know, I try and keep that kind of belief in it sometimes. Well, you know.
Well, the wonder of professional wrestling is that some of it is real and some of it isn't. You never really know where the line exists, so you're always looking, always thinking, like, "Am I being fooled or am I being wowed, or both?"
It's true, and with especially that era of sort of the 80s and the 90s and stuff like that, from what you read, there are a lot of guys around at that time who have probably less than reputable, real, you know, life personas, I guess. But I think it's just a case of separating that as much as possible as a fan. Because, you know, I think if you had to judge, you know, wrestlers, some of them based on what you read, then you probably really wouldn't like any of them because of some of the stuff that they've done or have been reported to have done.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's also, I think, important to remember that they're humans and that they have good days and bad days and good periods and bad periods.
Yeah.
So when you're on the road, it beats the hell out of you. You know, it sounds sexy and glamorous, but it just destroys you. And everybody gets a little ornery at times and has troubles at times. So when I was dealing with guys and they were struggling or being difficult, I try to remember that maybe it isn't them, maybe it's the environment that we're working in, and they just need time.
I hope everyone is enjoying my interview with Tom Buchanan. I'll be back in a jiffy.
Meet Barry. He wanted to get a website for his removal business. He searched online, met a number of web companies, ended up with too many options to take on board. Then he hired a web company. The company built a website, but there were many corrections. The company did not understand Barry's business. Barry then found Planet John. His website was designed and built on 1 week's time. The site comes with free maintenance and works on laptops and smartphones. We even told the World Wide Web about Barry's business at no extra cost. What are you waiting for? Contact us, www.pltjohn.com.
And now, back to the show. Going back to the venues that you worked in, did you work in the more unusual venues, such as the nightclubs for Shotgun Saturday Night or the Manhattan Center for Raw? And were they difficult to...
Yeah, I worked in all of those. I covered Raw and I covered Shotgun for every single event that we did in that series. Manhattan Center was an easy venue to shoot in. We were there every week, so it was just a matter of setting our lights up once, and then when it's time to shoot the show, you turn on the lights and you shoot. So that was relatively easy to shoot in. It was an ugly venue. I didn't like it, and I didn't like the look or the feel of it. Our photography was generally designed to look the same. So a picture in Madison Square Garden should look the same as a picture from Des Moines, Iowa, or Chicago, or any place else, or London, England. So again, 80-90% of our arena action should be generic, and just another 10-20% should look different. Manhattan Center always looked different, and it always looked small. So I didn't like it from a photography standpoint, but it was an easy place to work. Shotgun was always, it was supposed to be a really raw kind of show, so we shot that one flash on camera or with high-speed film, so it was, again, an easy one to shoot. And it was always weird. It was always a different setting and a different crowd, and yeah, that I liked it and I didn't like it.
Yeah, how did you feel about a midnight live shoot?
It depends where we were.
Okay.
You know, there was one where we were in Penn Station in the middle of Manhattan, and it was just absolute mayhem. And I turned to a police officer there and asked him if he had ever seen anything like this. And he just said, yeah, but we don't usually have a ring in the building.
Oh, go for it.
Go ahead.
No, sorry.
I was going to say we did another one down in Texas at a country club, a country music club. Totally different audience and totally different vibe. So that show always felt different no matter where you were.
Well, I want to go back to taking promotional photos. So if there was ever a vignette, because I know you talked to me about the Wayland Mercy thing, and I would love you to go into that. Did you always come along to take pictures, because obviously the setting was suitable for the character?
Yeah. If we were doing a TV promotional with a character, we had a photographer there. So we worked closely with TV to make sure that we knew what was happening and that we had a photographer on set for all of those. Wayland Mercy was at a small park in Stamford, Connecticut. So he was his character was kind of this backwoods, there was a movie that the character was based on.
Cape Fear,
yeah. So that's what his character was spun off of. So we were trying to shoot him at this park on Long Island Sound, kind of a river ocean setting. So we did that through the day. Vince McMahon was producing that. It went really, really well. And he decided at the last minute that he would keep going. So we wanted to shoot it at night as well. So he kept Wayland Mercy over. He put the crew on kind of a pause while we went through sunset. Then we would reshoot again at darkness. Now, the park was probably a mile from World Wrestling Federation corporate headquarters, and Vince had a corner office that looked right out on that park. So we're during the sunset period. We're not shooting. We're just kind of hanging out, lounging, relaxing. And a couple of friends happened by in the park and said hello to me, one of them on a pair of rollerblades. And Vince looked at me after a while and said, "Tom, I never knew this place was here." Which I thought was odd, because it's a mile outside of his office window. If he just looked out the office,
yeah,
he would know it was there. So that was the Wayland Mercy shoot. We picked it up again that evening and shot at night, and there you go.
It's incredible, though. It shows you how much Vince, I don't know, just maybe at the expense of just about everything else, will put the company first.
Yeah, he was intensely focused. Absolutely, wrestling was his life. And that's why the company succeeded. It was his creative. It was his life.
Yeah.
And he is.
So, speaking of the headquarters, were you there for the Raw on the Roof shoot?
Yeah, I was.
What was that like? Because I don't think, from what I've heard, I mean, Kevin Nash hated it, apparently. I think he hated the process of doing it.
It was a film shoot, so not videotape, it was film.
Yeah.
I believe it was produced by a guy named David Sahadi. David is an incredibly brilliant producer and creative, but when he's doing whatever he's doing, you have no idea where it's going to go. Like, it just looks like a mess. But he knows exactly what he's after, he gets the shots he's after, and he makes the thing into art. He's a filmmaker, really. So the first part of that shoot was, it didn't make any sense to people that were there. You just saw fragments of what was happening. The second piece of that shoot is that the office building is in a commercial strip along a main road, but right off that main road is residential. So you've got pyro going off. You've got helicopters with searchlights flashing all over. You've got loud music. You've got cars. You've got all kinds of stuff going on in this essentially residential neighborhood. It was bizarre.
I believe they let fans up there as well.
Yeah, we needed people. I think there was a point where a lot of people rushed a gate. So we had an open call. A lot of those were office people, but we had other folks there too.
Oh.
It was a madhouse. It was definitely an event and a night that I will always remember. And I was really impressed with where we went with it.
Oh, it looked amazing. I'll go for it. Sorry, we're going to keep headbutting, and it's my fault. But I was going to say it looks amazing as well. And that footage got used for years after that.
Yeah, it was the start of the Attitude Era. But as we were shooting that, nobody understood what the Attitude Era was. Vince hadn't articulated that yet. So we were seeing Attitude, but we didn't understand how that fit into our, what had been the cartoon era.
Yeah.
So it was a major turning point for all of us and for the company.
So around that time, they introduced the WWF blimp, which I believe you had or were heavily involved in. Now, what was your role with that?
So I was a skydiver at the time, and I really wanted to jump out of a blimp. Like, I had jumped out of helicopters, and I had jumped out of balloons and lots of different airplanes. I really wanted to jump out of a blimp, but no blimp operator would allow that to happen. There's too much liability. It's too weird. So I traced down an operator at Kissimmee Airport in Florida. The SeaWorld blimp was based there, and went and talked to them and asked them if they would let me jump from their blimp, and they blew me off just automatically, not a chance. Right across the hall, there was a desk for a brand new blimp company run by Virgin. So I stopped over there and asked the chief pilot, you know, I'd like to do something weird. He said, okay, what is it? I told him I want to jump out of your airplane or out of your blimp. He said, okay, what do you want to do that's weird? He was my guy, right? So he was into it, but he had to clear it with Richard Branson first. Branson heard the pitch and was immediately focused. He thought it was a wonderful idea. Yeah, go for it. So I wound up jumping from the Virgin Atlantic blimp. It was such a good promotion, and I liked the company so well that I told our marketing department about it, that we could put our own banners on this blimp and make a WWE blimp or WWF blimp at the time. Our marketing department bought into that, and we leased the blimp for two different periods. So that's how we got the WWF blimp.
And there was recently WWE on YouTube had a little series about the warehouse, just because they have they've kept everything basically, and they still have the blimp.
The blimp.
Or they have a blimp. It may not be the same one.
But they wouldn't have. They wouldn't have the blimp because it wasn't really the blimp.
Okay.
It was a big white blimp. And then you put banners on the side for your company.
Okay.
So they lease it to whoever wanted the blimp. So they probably have the banners from that, and they probably have some of the little blimps that we sold. So we sold these little inflatable blimps, and I have one of those someplace too.
I've got one of those. It's amazing. See, did you see, I mean, this is for no one else at this point, but I've got this random blimp merchandise. It's kind of like a writing pad and a sticker with date where the blimp was going to be, I think.
Okay, yep.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen that or not, but I do have those.
Yep, there were two sets of those, I think. The first one that I remember and that I know I have a set of would be from the cartoon era with that stupid yellow WWF logo. And I think there was another one from the Attitude Era. The philosophy behind a blimp promotion is you rent it for 6 weeks or whatever your time period is, but you want to maximize your power. So we actually rented it for a day long in advance, probably a month in advance. At that point, it was being used by Family Channel, a very family-friendly TV station. So we rented it and put our banner on one side for one day and ran it out in the countryside someplace so we could shoot pictures of it and say, the blimp is coming, the blimp is coming. So we got an extra probably 4 or 5 weeks of pre-use promotion out of it, and then launched the actual blimp promotion and then followed up with more production after that. So that was really effective.
So was it that blimp that you jumped out of on WWF television?
Yes.
It was that blimp.
Yep.
For the Special Olympics, yeah. I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, we had two different blimp rentals. One was that one, and the other was during the Attitude Era. The first one was going to be, I think we culminated at the Special Olympics, which Linda McMahon was a sponsor of. So I jumped out of the WWF cartoon era blimp into the Special Olympics World Games in Connecticut. The second blimp rental was during the Attitude Era. That one was supposed to bookend with the on-sale date at a pay-per-view in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I was supposed to jump out of it and then land in the Pittsburgh arena. It had a retractable roof. But weather prevented that blimp from making the flight into Pittsburgh, so we didn't have that on sale.
With skydiving, there was another thing, and there was a picture in the magazine as well with you, I believe Shane McMahon, the 123 kid, and maybe Alundra Blaze, maybe?
Yep, so you got it right.
I know too much. So what was that for? Was that just random, or was that for a specific event?
Yeah, that was just random. We always tried to have features of the talent doing things. And Kid really wanted to jump out of an airplane. I was a tandem instructor, so I could take him. We had an event in Poughkeepsie, New York, which was about 45 minutes from where I normally did my skydiving. So we just dragged the talent out of Pittsburgh, brought him over to my drop zone. We did a couple of jumps and shot it for videotape and ran it into the shows. Shane McMahon also wanted to jump. I was supposed to take him as well, but we ran out of time, so somebody else took Shane.
Two-part question, because something's just came to mind as well. Did you and Shane get along particularly well because of the whole, you know, with him being a daredevil and with you doing stuff like that as well?
Not really. We got along mostly, but not especially well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he seems very, I don't know, the most agreeable member of the family, I think.
Yeah, I would probably say that. He has a stubborn streak, and he has a power streak. And we kind of butted heads a couple points as he moved into the new media role.
Yes.
And it was a problem for Stephanie, too, that these are young folk that don't have years and years of experience, and suddenly they are executives. And they have to somehow fill that role. And they kind of, both of them approached it with a little bit more attitude than they needed. And it really rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But they had to assert themselves, I suppose.
Well, before I get into the website, there's a photo shoot that, it's just come to mind. It was because he was skydiving or he was bungee jumping. It was one of the Beverly Brothers. Do you remember that, or were you involved in any part of that?
No recollection of that one at all.
it was in the back of a magazine. That just completely, just randomly came to mind.
Oh, I've got some kind of, maybe a TV show someplace. Maybe it could have been Calgary. I know there was someplace. There was a bungee jump I did in Calgary and one I did someplace in Florida, and some other talent was involved in one of those. But it was a bit story. I don't remember any details, I'm afraid.
Okay. Now, I know that was a shitty place to end it. But you know what they say. You know, leave them wanting more. Part two will be next week. There is so much more that we talked about as well. So it's not one of those ones where you think all the good stuff's in part one and all that was left was in part two. No, this delivers. Like SD Special Delivery Jones, it delivers. And not in a 9-second. Second, which was really a 27-second match against King Kong Bundy. No, it's 4 hours of wonderful content, unlike WrestleMania 4. No, that's unfair. I like WrestleMania 4. I might be in the minority, but there we are. And I'm just rambling now. So yes, do check out Hands Off the Merchandise, Turnchuckle, the other podcast. All on BBG Wrestling on SoundCloud and bbgwrestling.com, and check out all of that good stuff on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, MySpace, BearShare, Message in a Bottle, and Carrier Pigeon. We're on all those streaming devices. So yes, see you all next week.
Goodbye.
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 Goodbye.